and I'm an alcoholic, and I have a sobriety date. It's July 1st of 2006. I have a sponsor, and I have a home group, and I'm very grateful to be here, and there's a lot going on in my brain right now. My good friend Claire and I just had a lot of, like, good conversation in the car, and I was just thinking about how different it is nowadays, like, the substance of what I talk about with my friends and, like, the people that I really call my friends and, like, who I go to for the real stuff, just the substance of, like, what we actually talk about is so different than what it used to be. And that's actually, like, what we were talking about. And I'll kind of get to that later down the road. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time talking about my drinking, but I do think that it's really important to qualify, because when I was new, when I would go to meetings, and I heard what I thought were people just talking, and I'm sure that they were carrying a great message. Like, I'm sure that they probably were. I was incapable of hearing that message, though, at the time, because what I heard was about how great your lives were now that you weren't drinking. And all I could think about was how miserable my life was now that I wasn't drinking, and I didn't know, like, how I was going to get to where you were, and I didn't know if I even wanted to. So I really stayed in meetings to hear people, like, talk about their drinking, because then at least I could relate to that, and I could at least say, like, okay, well, you kind of know where I'm coming from. Like, maybe I'll try and believe you. And so I do think that it's really important to qualify. And, you know, back where I'm sober, there's a lot of, like, younger people. And I think it's a double-edged sword, because I think I don't think that AA has saved the whales. You know, like, if you want to get sober, then you can come to AA, and, like, there is medicine, like, the message and all that's here, and it's open to you. But I don't believe that it's my job to force anybody to take it. I think that's actually doing a disservice to AA, because there are plenty of people that should be sober or that even want to be sober that aren't sober. And then there are plenty of people who I may, you know, in my self-righteous thought think, like, oh, they don't deserve to be sober, but they're doing AA, so they get to be sober. That's just how it works. With that being said, there's two things I always like to preface saying when I speak. And the first is that what I'm about to share is just my experience. I don't speak for AA as a whole. I don't speak for my home group as a whole. That's a big one, because there's been a lot of, in my own experience in sobriety, where sometimes a couple people's actions or words or whatever can taint an entire group, and I think that that's really unfortunate in AA. So I don't speak for my home group, I don't speak for AA as a whole, I don't speak for my sponsor. All of those things are great. This is just my experience, you know, like, and if you don't relate, that's actually totally fine. There's plenty of people that I don't relate to in AA, but it doesn't mean that there's not a message in there. So this is just my experience, and I think that as alcoholics and as a sober alcoholic nowadays, like, before, sure, like, there are things like, I have my money, I can, you know, buy someone dinner and all that stuff, but the real currency that I think I have in AA is time and experience. You know, like, I can giving of your time, like, picking up a phone call in the middle of the night can mean more to somebody than a $100 steak dinner. You know, like, when I've been crazy and insane and, like, wanting to drink, or, like, in my own self-created insanity, or in the obsession to drink, or in the obsession of something I have made my higher power, and, like, on the verge of taking a drink or on the verge of taking actions that might put my sobriety in jeopardy, if I can call someone and they give me their time, or if I can hang out with someone and they can give me their time, or even just respecting the meeting enough to, like, listen, that's, like, someone's time, you know, like, that is real currency in AA. That's really what we have to give. And then also our experience, because, like, my experience, your experience, whatever that is, it's an unshakable truth. You know, like, experience, like, opinions, those change. You know, like, actions could be good or bad, but, like, my experience, like, what I've actually gone through and made it to the other side of, like, that is what I can really give and help somebody. Because it means that I'm not talking out of my rear end. You know, like, it's something that I've actually, like, done. So that's why I do these things. That's why I drive down or up or wherever, you know, like, and it's been pretty funny because I'll explain it a little more later on, but I'm just coming off of, I broke my hip in two places in the beginning of March, and that set off a period of time where I got really dark, and I got dark for two reasons, and I was actually really embarrassed to talk about it honestly for a long time, because my own fear of judgment kept me from talking about it, and it got me sicker. It got, like, myself sicker. But what happened was, so I fractured my hip in two places. So I was skiing for my 30th birthday, and I literally just, like, fell, and I broke my hip. Like, I don't know how it happened. Like, I just was like, boop, and it broke. And that led to being bedridden for a little. Well, I tried to go to work the next 2 days later, I tried, and they were like, "You're gray. We need you to leave." So that happened, and then figuring it all out, and it took a little while to get diagnosed and all this stuff, but because of MRIs and X-rays and all this craziness. But what ended up happening were two things. Was one, I was kind of bedridden, and so I couldn't go to a lot of meetings. And two was because I was in such excruciating pain, I had to take pain medication, and I was terrified of talking about that at meetings because of things, either, opinions that people had, convictions other people thought that maybe, whatever. It doesn't even matter what they thought. I was afraid, and I created this fear that I was going to be judged and that people were going to think I needed to change my sobriety date or whatever, so I didn't talk about it. And my friends, Claire included, offered to bring me meetings, but I was so scared of, I literally just hold myself away for close to a month. And I think I maybe got to 4 meetings in those 4 weeks. And I was listening to speaker tapes. I was reading the big book. Yes, I was praying. I was doing all those things. But my God speaks through people. And so taking that such a big part of my God away from me really got me to a pretty dark place. And so so that's why I always say that this is my experience, because it might not be yours and it might be different, but it is an unshakable truth for me. And I do think that it's really important to talk about those things. So, that's the first thing. And then, the second thing, so experience and time. And then the second thing that I also always love to say is that I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I really do. And, I have subscribed, I have drank the Kool-Aid, whatever you want to say. I got sober when I was pretty young. And I really hated the people that got up there and talked about how grateful they were. People that were I shared about being grateful were the bane of my existence. I would eye roll so hard I could probably see the back of my skull. I was just you are so full of it. I just didn't believe it. I just didn't, I didn't believe it. But I have now become one of those people. I have subscribed. I have a great life today. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love meetings, ups, downs, whatever, when I can get to a good meeting where I can be of service and also get a message, those are great days. I have been able, I've been given a lot of gifts and I've been blessed with a lot of great outside things, not outside issues. Outside issues are things like politics and religion, not drugs. I think drugs are just drugs, personally for me. But outside issues, I don't talk about politics or any of that crap because I have watched it destroy friendships, destroy meetings, just a lot of stuff. So, but I've been given a lot of things that aren't directly related to AA, but I do think that they're related to AA in a sense, because yes, in the big book, we are promised sobriety. It's that's what we're promised. We're told that if we do these things, that we will be sober. That's but I don't think that being sober is just not drinking, because if it was just not drinking, I would not still be here, because just not drinking does not provide me a substantial enough life to be happy. I am too needy. I am too, I'm human, just being sober every day, that sounds miserable actually. And what I read in the big book, just personally for me, is that, and it talks about it in promises all throughout the book. It talks about it in prayer and direction all throughout the book. We're actually promised, just being sober means so much more to me now. It's not just not drinking. It means being able to practice principles in all areas of my life. So I show up to work on time and I'm a valued employee. I can show up for my friendships and I'm, asked to be a maid of honor in a wedding, or my friends tell me that I'm the one that they know if they call that if I say I'm going to do something, that it is going to get done. That's more of an honor than anything else, because you couldn't, I was 3 sheets to the wind every time I did anything. You never knew if Sarah was going to show up drunk, show up sober, show up angry, fight somebody, go to jail, you never knew, So someone saying, if I asked you to do something, I could just ask you and know it would be done. That's the biggest compliment. So I believe that just being sober, just not drinking, is not what's promised to us. I really think it's it means I get to have a whole new life. And it's pretty amazing considering the gates of insanity that I was living in before, at the gates of insanity. So, with that being said, I'll briefly qualify. I was, born into a family of alcoholism, both on my mom and my dad's side. And the reason I think that that's important to say is because I have a twin sister. You cannot get more same than that, right? We were brought up in the exact same household. We have the same DNA, everything. We're the same. We look very different, but we are like the same makeup. We were brought up in the same home. My family was very big about, if my sister got X, Sarah got X. If I got Y, Maya got Y. Like everything was very even. They made sure of it. So she is not an alcoholic. And that is really important for Sarah to understand and for me to know, because for so long, I would look at things that happened when I was younger or situations, circumstances, and think that that is the, that was a reason why I was an alcoholic. And I don't believe that that's true to this day, and I have to remember that. I absolutely think that it gave me ammunition to drink alcoholically, but I don't believe that it is what makes me an alcoholic. Whether I was born with it, I picked it up, I don't care. It doesn't matter to me, because at the end of the day, I have spent time trying to figure all that stuff out, and it has led me to nothing but insanity, trying to figure it out. And for me, it's if I can find a reason why I'm alcoholic, it means that maybe I can find a way around not being alcoholic. Like, I can find a way to not be alcoholic. And that's why it's important for me to remember, you know, your sister grew up in the exact same household, the exact same way, and she is not an alcoholic. Not even just like a sibling, your twin, like the exact same. And she's not alcoholic. But I started drinking when I was 12. Before that, I was just uncomfortable. And I think I knew to a degree that I was uncomfortable and that I didn't feel right, but I was filling up my time and my energy with things like sports or school or whatever, drama. I mean, even from a very young age, like I fed off of drama. And so from like a very young age, I was drawn to it. And so I did feel to a degree different, but a lot of the stuff that I can say now about myself is all in hindsight. So basically, I grew up in this great home. My family was awesome. And if love could keep someone sober, like I never would have started drinking. 100%. Great life, like awesome, super cool. My sponsor, complete opposite, and she's my sponsor because I relate to her on like a whole nother level. And it just goes to show that circumstances don't have anything to do with who you can get help from in AA. So grew up in a great home, but I was always just off, and it was little things like, why tell the truth when you can lie? Just those little thought processes that I would have that weren't normal, and I didn't even know they weren't normal. But just those little things where it was like, why do the right thing? Like, why study when you can cheat? Just those, and that's like, those are the things that I was drawn to, like, from the beginning. Like, always, like, do as little as possible, but get the greatest outcome. Like, from the beginning, I was like that. And that doesn't lead to anything productive, but it felt like it was ingrained in me from the beginning. So I think my parents said no to giving me something, so I decided to kill myself. Again, very odd reactions to things, you know, and that's a theme through like my life is here is an action and my reaction is up here, you know, like something happens and I go to 100 in a split second and my reaction like does not match the action. And I'm a very reactive person, and my parents like to call it passionate. The police like to call it aggressive. I did not react well to anything that didn't go my way, pretty much. So, and I would have these very passionate reactions to everything. And so, you know, my parents said no, so I tried to kill myself because that seemed action to reaction. My reaction seemed to make sense. And what ended up happening was and another thing that's important is, so I, being dramatic, you know, like got all dressed up and like took a bottle of aspirin and then followed it with vodka and then laid in my bed and waited to die, dramatically listening to my boombox. And then got this overwhelming sense that like, and I believe this is the hidden hand. I call my God, like my God, I think shows up in like the hidden hand, not only through people, but like weird coincidences that happen in my life that I can't explain. Like I believe that that's my higher power working in my life. So I just got this very overwhelming sense that something like that this was not a good idea. And so I called my dad, who worked on Capitol Hill at the time, And I told him, I was like, I did something bad. And he reacted in the same way a dad would do in the middle of the workday, getting bothered by his dramatic liar of a 12-year-old daughter, and was like, what did you do? And I already heard that annoyed sort of like, I'm going to get in trouble tone of voice. So my reaction was, again, is to cover it up. I'm someone where I create chaos. Like, I'll pull down all the books off a shelf, and then I'll, like, so quietly, like, bow out and, like, let you all deal with it and like, watch rats, you know, like, scamper. I just, like, I like to tear things down and then I back out, like, what? I didn't do anything because I take no responsibility for my actions. So when I heard that, I was like, I'm fine. I was just being dramatic, you know, like, don't worry about it. And what I didn't know until I got sober was that my dad literally was on Capitol Hill giving a speech and, like, walked out. He just walked out and drove home because he was afraid that something had happened to me. And those are just, like, the little things that I have no real grasp of, like, the level of damage or the situations that I created in my drinking. And a lot of them have come up after the fact, in the ninth step a lot too. And it's hard, you know, like, it's hard to deal with those things, like, knowing that the damage that I did to other people, and just, like, being like a pebble I was the pebble in people's shoes, you know, like, irritating, always, you know, like, sometimes, sure, you know, like, it could be bigger than that, but just constantly irritating everyone around me. Like, that's what I did. And I hadn't even started drinking. That's the crazy part. And that's, like, the important part, is that I was messed up. Like, just the drink, like, the alcohol alone is not my problem. I have the obsession, you know, like, I do have that allergy of the body. I do. I absolutely have that. And alcohol, you cannot be an alcoholic without drinking alcohol. I think that needs to be made very clear too. But I also have this spiritual malady that rests in my head. And that is, you know, whether they're the same, one is bigger, I don't know. But I know for me, the spiritual malady was there long before I took a drink. And so I hadn't even started drinking, and, like, that's how I reacted. So what ended up happening was I got really sick because I didn't tell anybody for about 2.5-3 days. And systematically my organs started shutting down, and, like, I started to, like, regurgitate my own organ, like, my stomach. I was throwing up my stomach pretty much. So my parents finally took me to the hospital, but I told them when I was literally, like, on the floor, like, I think going in and out of consciousness, I was like, I think I should tell somebody. So I told my parents what I had done, and because I was such a liar at that point, and they hadn't, like, because they had asked me, did you do anything to yourself? Did you do anything to yourself for, like, 2.5 days? And I was like, no. You know, like, how dare you accuse me? And then finally I come to them and I'm like, yes, I did. They went to back to school night because they, you know, they had my twin sister as well. And so they went to back to school night. And let me tell you something. I used that as a reason to drink for years after that, because I was like, you wanted me to die. You didn't care. You know, like, you didn't care if I told you I tried to kill myself and you left me. Oh my God. I mean, talk about flags. I wave a lot of flags, and victim is one of them. And like, you made me feel unsafe. That's the other one. So victim was the big one. And I was like, you wanted me to die, you know, like, but at back to school night, they kind of, I think they, like, mentioned it to, like, a PA or so, like, a teacher, one of the teachers. And they were kind of like, what are you doing here? And so they quickly came home, and I don't remember any of this, but basically I was shuttled off to the hospital, and it was pretty bad. And for a couple of days, my mom did nothing but just lay in the hospital bed with me. And then when I kind of woke up and came to, they had to pump my stomach, like, the whole night. But at that point, I'd already digested most of it. It was just bad. It was a bad scene. And when I woke up, again, no responsibility, after, like, 2 days of, like, basically being comatose, I just looked at my mom, who had not gotten up from, like, this bed. And I was like, why are you being so dramatic? Take me, take me home, basically. And I was subsequently immediately placed into the psych ward, because they do not look kindly upon people doing things like trying to kill themselves and then blaming everybody else. So I was put into the psych ward. I left the psych ward after 2 weeks, and the psych ward was important because that's where I got my first experience with learning how to play the game, the institution game, the jail game, the AA game. You pick up the lingo, you pick up how to, you know, get the gold stars and, like, monkey see a monkey do and spew a lot of BS, and you learn what to say. And I can do that quite well, actually. And so I learned, oh, you know, like, that's how I get out of here faster, and that's where I learned that was at the psych ward. So I got all my gold stars and I got out and I went back to school, and my sister, my twin sister, had told everybody what had happened. Because that's another one of those, you never know what kind of damage you've created. You know, like, I stole so much time and attention from my brother and sister in that household, just because everything was about, what is Sarah doing? Is Sarah safe? You know, like, is Sarah drinking? Is Sarah drunk? Everything turned into that. What, you know, like, I sucked the life out of that household. And my poor sister and brother had to grow up in that household where Sarah was the focus all of the time, constantly. It was like, they could never just have like a great day to themselves, because I inevitably would be a pebble in the shoe that you know, like, just caused something to go down. And so my sister reacted and told everyone, and I had a visceral reaction to people caring about me because I thought it was bullshit. And so I like left school. There was the kid in the parking lot. You're not supposed to, or he was in a playground, and, he's like, the kid you're not supposed to talk to. And he was like, oh, I heard you tried to kill yourself. And I was like, yeah. And he was like, are you okay? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, do you want to get high? And I was like, yeah. And that's like literally as simple as it was. And that was the first time I ever got high. And then I went immediately home and I found my dad's liquor cabinet, because I intuitively knew, one, I'm young and I'm probably not going to get my hands on a lot of drugs, so I need to find this alternative. And I knew, you know, I'd been to DARE. I knew about drinking. And so I just immediately went home that day and like found my dad's liquor cabinet. And he is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous now. He was not then. So he had a very, very well-stocked liquor cabinet, and especially for an alcoholic, because he had the right side, which was like the stuff I knew intuitively not to touch. The Kettle One, the Tanqueray, the, you know, the Belvedere, like all the good stuff. And then on the other side, he had these like plastic gallon jugs of vodka. And like that, I was just like, there it is. That's what I'm going to drink. And I did that, and I immediately found like, thank God, you know, like that's all it felt like. It wasn't, I'm going to do this for the rest of my life. It was just like, God, thank God. Like, it felt like I could breathe for the first time. And I didn't even know that I'd been holding my breath before that. But once I got that relief, it was like, holy cow. For the next 8 years, because I drank from the time I was 12 till I was 18, or 19, I'm sorry. For the next 9 years, I went in and out of the gates of insanity. I would get sober, I would not get sober. After that first initial drinking, that sparked a summer of trying to be smart, and I thought me and my best friend, we were going to weed out all the good and the bad. So we were going to try drinking as many different varieties of like beer and liquor as we could, and try as many different drugs as we could to like weed out which ones were good and bad. And he was not alcoholic, so he just had a great summer. I am alcoholic, and so I got three things out of that: that beer is a waste of my time, that tequila is never okay, and that there is always some pharmaceutical and or drug to alcohol mix that will get me to wherever I need to be, whether that's asleep, whether that's to clean, whether that's to do schoolwork. Like, I knew what I needed to drink, how much I needed to drink, and what I needed to take, and it would get me to that great level. And I did love uppers a lot, because it meant that I could actually stay awake and I could drink more. And like, this is stuff I'm figuring out at like 13. You know, like, that's not normal. That's not normal at all. But it was my, and it's true, like exactly what they say in the Big Book, the alcoholic life is the only normal one. Like, I was hanging out with other kids who were doing that stuff, and I was also like, that's just what I would do, you know, like, and it's not like I didn't know there was normality. I mean, my brother was in, like, sports went out the window for me. He stayed in, it's not like it just became more important. And like, that's again, like, that is what is the difference between me and another, like, someone who is not alcoholic. Like, I will always choose alcohol, always, no matter what. And they're kind of like, did my brother drink? Yeah, absolutely. Did my sister drink? Yeah, sure. Did they maybe get a little crazy sometimes and overdrink? Oh, absolutely. Did they go on binges? 100% they did. But what they didn't have is that when they took a drink, if they knew, like, when my sister would drink and she knew she had a crew meet the next day, like, she would stop. And for me, I would say that I was going to do that before I took a drink. And then the first sip that I took, I knew all bets were off. Because I had no idea what was going to happen from there. And even though I had every intention of stopping, somehow, some way, every single time, pretty much, I ended up in oblivion. Just every time. And so over the course of the next 8 years, all the stuff that we talk about happened. You know, like, I was arrested a number of times. I went in and out of rehabs, jails, institutions, psych wards, running away. You know, being that young, I did what all good young, you know, alcoholics do. I started dating a drug dealer. I, you know, just terrible relationships with everyone around me. I mean, anger became like my only emotion. Like, I was just angry all of the time. I was either angry because I didn't have enough, blacked out, or angry because I wasn't messed up and like I was sober. And I just, anger was like my only, it was the only emotion that I was capable of. You know, like, I was very aggressive and like physically abusive to the people around me and my family. I pushed everybody out of my life. My parents for a long time were just like, if you can just do well in school, we will leave you alone. That is like, that sounds like perfection to me. You know, like, and it does, because in my alcoholic brain, I'm thinking, why couldn't I just do that? You know, like, all I had to do was go to school. If I just went to school, they would have left me alone. But it's because I'm alcoholic, because school becomes unimportant when I am drinking. It started out as really fun. Like, it was, I had a really good time drinking for a long time, going to parties and like doing crazy stuff and like just being like free loving and like all that stuff. It did. It started out as fun. But over the course of those 8 years, I lost the power of choice, because King Alcohol, 100%. I love that description of it. Alcohol was my master, 100%. I did nothing. Every decision that I made was it got to a point where I just wanted to drink and have fun. And by the end, every decision that I made was based on getting to my next drink or because I was drunk and doing something insane. I mean, every single decision. And I can't tell you or plot out like how that happened. And like, I could tell a lot of stories, like a big drunk log, but I can't tell you how that happened. And that, I believe, is alcoholism. It is the course that alcoholism takes, that once you take a drink, all bets are off. You know, like, I have no power of choice, and I can be stopped, and I can want to stay stopped. I really can. But then somewhere down the road, I think I've made a decision that I want to drink again. I've made that decision. That's what I tell myself. And I pick up again every single time. And so, through this, there was one little nugget of like wonderfulness, and that's that I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, because my dad had actually gotten sober at this point. When I was 15, he got sober, and he got sober for two reasons. The first was because I was putting sleeping pills in his wine, and he would take two bottles of wine to the face every night, and so I was putting sleeping pills in his wine so that he would fall asleep faster, so that I could go out and drink how I wanted to. So that was the first thing. So he declined quickly. And it was quite apparent to the people around that he was declining quickly, and his drinking, the mask was taken off fairly quickly. We can laugh about that now. He did not find that funny for a very long time. So he and I laugh about that now, though. That was not fun when that all came out in one of those like drug rehabs where they're like, write out everything you've ever done and read it to your parents. You know, like, did one of those. That was not the right decision. So my dad got sober and I was still drinking. And then there was like a pretty nasty arrest in there too, where I was caught, trying to deal drugs on school property, and they like really don't look kindly upon that. So I had to like jump through a lot of hoops to get out of that. And part of that was I ended up getting shipped away for a while, for like 2 months. And when I came back, my dad was sober, like sober. And he was sober in this group called the Delray Club up in Bethesda when they still met on Delray Avenue. And, he went out, they had this lunch bunch that went out every single Sunday. They went to a meeting and then they went to lunch afterward. And my dad, being a loving parent and just wanting to help me, my good old dadu, I call him dadu. And so dadu would wake me up every Sunday and I would be either still drunk, still high, or like in the act of like drinking. And he would kind of just like shove a sweatshirt on me and like drag me out and put me in the car. And he would take me to the AA meeting. You know, like, he would take me to the Delray Club and he would just sit me in a corner and he would let me smoke. And that's like probably the only reason why I didn't put up too much of a fight. And he would just stick me in the corner and they would have an AA meeting around me, and like none of them bothered me. Like, they were just all very nice guys and like women, and they were just very nice. Like, they didn't try to talk AA at me or anything. Like, I think they could just tell that I wasn't ready, but they were just nice. And what they did is they made AA a safe place where I, in my mind, knew if it gets bad enough that I want to die, then I'll go to AA. That's like what I got out of those meetings. And then they would take me out to lunch and shove a hamburger in my face, you know, like, and try to get me to eat because I was like a stick. I was 5, you know, I'm 5'8", and I was like 87, 90 pounds. So it was not healthy. So they would just like shove a hamburger and french fries in my face, and they would just talk about AA around me and like it planted the seed. And thank God for those men. And a lot of them are still sober. And that's what I think is amazing. I love seeing people like who have like long-term sobriety who you haven't seen in a while, and then you see them and it's like, oh my God, you made it. It like reaffirms my hope that like, wait, this thing does work. Like it really does. Because we see so many people leave, you know, like we see so many people die, and we see so many people not do it and then not get it and drink again. And so what ended up happening, nuts and bolts. So we'll get to nuts and bolts. What ended up happening was I started going to AA meetings because my dad said that that was the only reason that they tried to put me on lockdown a bunch, but AA meetings was always a thing that I could go to. And I was introduced to a young people's group because I had to go to like one of those schools for a while. I was like asked not to return to an entire county of schools. And so I had no other option but to go to one of those like color in the lines and pee in a cup and then we'll let you graduate schools. And so there, part of the thing was you had to go to 3 meetings a week. And so for a while there, I was trying to drink and still go. And like, I would go to meetings and I would just like sign my own slips and like, but I would sign it with my own name because like it's just, I was just a bad cheater and like sober. Like drinking, I could totally do it, but I was just like awful. Like I would sign it with the same, like I wasn't even smart enough to like use 2 different pens or like sign it in a different penmanship. I was awful at it. But what ended up happening was my dad said, look, you can go to meetings. I will let people pick you. You can't take the car, but you can have people pick you up and you can go to AA meetings. And so I started going to young people's meetings, and that was a whole nother ballgame because it was actually people that I felt like I could relate to, and it was exciting, and it was fun, and it was like, oh my gosh, there's like all this stuff. But the problem was I wasn't ready. And I always am careful to say that because I think that I don't want people to ever think, because I am someone that I'll use anything as an excuse not to do this. And like, I will pull that card where I can be like, yeah, sure, I wasn't ready. Or I can pull the card of like, you know, I'm just not ready. I need to go try some controlled drinking. Or like, I'm just not ready. I might not be alcoholic. Like, I can do that today with like 11 years sober. I can totally do that today. So I have to be, I'm careful when I say that, but I wasn't ready in the sense that I made it very apparent. I just went to the meeting. It took me 4 hours to get ready to go to every meeting because you would think that I was like walking a freaking runway. You know, it took 4 hours to get ready for every meeting. I would go, I'd ride up in a bunch of cars being obnoxious with like, just being obnoxious. Just go to the meeting. I'd leave halfway through to go smoke cigarettes and then not go back for the other half of the meeting. I had a sponsor by name. I just went to the hangs because it was exciting and fun. I stayed out till 4 in the morning drinking coffee and energy drinks and smoking cigarettes. I never worked a step. I never really actually called my sponsor other than when something, like, I wanted her to, like, fix something and not AA related. Like, I wanted her to, like, he broke up with me, fix it. You know, like, not AA related. Like, I just wanted her to, like, micromanage my life. So really all I was doing was going to meetings and I was barely doing that, you know, like, and so people knew, like, yeah, absolutely. They would give me, if I asked for their time, they would give it to me, but like people knew that I wasn't ready. So I, you know, got a third step, AKA I got a boyfriend, and then I left AA because he left AA. He drank and I drank because I didn't have a God, you know, like I didn't have anything in between me and that other drink, because at 4 o'clock in the morning when I'm not at a meeting and that's all I was doing in AA was just going to the meeting, there was nothing between me and that next drink, you know, like, and he left and then he called me a month later and I left. It was literally as simple as that. And that's why it's been made so apparent to me that a higher power is like the most important thing for me to have today. Because without that, like there is no chance of me staying sober. Zero. You know, like I know people who go on retreats and go to places where they don't speak English and they're able to stay sober because they have a higher power. So no meetings and no people to talk to. Like, and I think that that's wonderful and amazing, but it's because they have a higher power. So I know, because humans will always fail me. And I know that sometimes meetings aren't there, you know, like aren't an option. You know, like I have to have something in between me and that next drink. I have to have something that is keeping me here. And that has become clear to me that it is the steps, and the steps help me get a God. And then when I get a God, I'm happy. And then I can go to meetings and have friends. And then friends lead me back to being accountable to like having a God and working the steps. And it's like, and then it starts the circle, you know, like, and I can stay sober. So, And if you don't know how to get a God, because for a long time I didn't know how, it's right here. It actually says that that's the point of what this book is to help you find a power greater than yourself. So whenever I am struggling with my third step, when bad things happen or life is happening, usually what I'll do is I'll go through the big book again, because it will reaffirm, you know, my faith in a higher power. And that's what the book was meant for, to take me through the steps and to help me find a God. And so I met a boy, I left, and the next 2.5 years were the worst 2.5 years of my life. You know, like, he and I were extremely abusive to each other. I picked up a lot of nasty drug habits, and I was going to die. And that's, like, plain and simple, I was going to die. I was drinking every single day. I was physically addicted to alcohol. I would go into DTs in the middle of the night. Like, I couldn't even, like, pass out for long enough because I would wake up in DTs. And, you know, and I'm like 17 years old, like, this is insane, you know, like, and I would just look at, like, how did I get here? And I had no, and I, again, I can't tell you, it just, like, that's just alcoholism, you know, like, it became my everything, and I lost the power of choice. And so what ended up happening was I went home after my boyfriend beat me up for the last time, and I was getting ready to go out that night, because, again, nothing is going to stop me from my next drink. Nothing is going to stop me. No broken bone, no person, no relationship, no tears. Nothing is going to stop me from getting to my next drink, because I needed it like I needed oxygen. Because I was filled with not only, like, shame and guilt, because I was so filled with shame and guilt of my actions, and not even my actions of drinking, because you can always fall back on, like, well, I was drunk, so it's okay. I was more ashamed of the actions that I took sober to get to my next drink, whether that was physically removing my mother from my presence or my sister. You know, I have vague memories of taking my sister and slamming her against the slamming her against like the bathroom tile, and literally breaking the tile with the back of her head because she was getting in the way of me and my next drink. Just like awful. That filled me up with shame and guilt. But also just the absolute obsession, because I was drinking around the clock. And once I took one, the obsession was on, and I had to get another. And living in that, like, that and the fear of being sick from the drugs that I was on, like, just the fear, like, that, living that way it's insanity. Like, it is truly the definition of insanity. And that's how I lived day in and day out. Like, it was Groundhog Day every single day. And was I unhappy? Yes, but it was my life, and I did it every single day. Just waking up, fiending for the next drink, willing myself not to be sick, and, like, doing what I needed to do to make sure that I wasn't going to get sick, and getting to the next drink day after day after day after day. I moved in with my boyfriend. I hated my family, all that stuff. But, you know, he beat me up for the last time. And so I, you know, being all dramatic. And his mom actually said to me, as I was leaving his house for the last time, his mom said to me, and she had her, she was a wonderful woman. And actually I was able to, like, make my peace with her, which was amazing. But what she said to me was, she just said, honey, if the drugs don't kill you, he's going to. You need to get out of here. He's like, your lifestyle is going to kill you. And I went home, and I was getting ready to go out, because after all the crazy that had happened that day, like, I needed that drink. I needed the next drink. I needed to get another drink. And my dad was sober at this time, and they were like, they got smart. They were like, they wouldn't have alcohol in the house, like, no wine, no nothing. I think I've had wine 2 times in my life. Because I just don't see the point. And then getting sober, I remember thinking to myself, if I could just learn to drink wine like a lady, I would be okay. And the great obsession of, you know, most alcoholics is how to somehow find a way to finagle their way to get drinking again. But I distinctly remember being like, if I could just, whatever it is, if I could just not do drugs, I'd be fine, and just drink, I'll be fine. If I can just drink wine like a lady, if I just drink beer, I hate beer, but if I just drink beer, I'll be fine. It's just insanity. I went home, I went to go get out. My mom came in, she saw me changing, and I was like changing to get out. And so I was gray, bruised, yellow, track marks, reeking of liquor, getting ready to 87 pounds, just like a mess. And my poor little mom, who's like one of the most wonderful women in the entire world. Like, she's I know everybody says that. She is legitimately like one of the best people. She will take, like, literally, she has like done for my friend. I mean, friends of mine have been like in a way, and she's like literally written them a check to like help them pay their rent. I mean, she's a wonderful person. She's a wonderful person. And she came into my room, and she, you know, and she, the other thing too, she has a faith in a God that I envy. Like, her faith is unshakable. Bad things happen and I'm immediately like, why God, why are you doing this to me? And you're like, her faith is unshakable. And it's something that I admire. And I mean, she's just amazing to me. And so she saw me changing and she got really upset, you know, cause she saw me at like my absolute like worst. And she just came up to me and she grabbed me by my shoulders. And it was like, I was so broken at that point, like physically, mentally, everything. Like, I mean, she would touch me and I would bruise. Like, you would grab me and I would literally bruise. And she was just shaking me and she was like, tell me what you need me to do to help you and I will do anything, anything. She's like, anything in the world, Sarah, just tell me, I will do it right here. Like, where do you need to go? Anything. And she's crying and she's crying. And I knew what she was doing. You know, she was trying to get me to not go out that night. And that was not a question that, like, it's, there was no, I had to go out that night and I knew that she was in the way of my next drink. And so I looked her dead in the eye and I told her, Mom, if you don't let me go out tonight, I'm going to kill you in your sleep. And I laughed at her and I watched that poor woman break right in front of me. And in the ninth step, it talks about the ninth step promises is that we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. And to this day, 11 years sober, and I've made amends to her and I talk to her almost every single day, I still regret that. And I do. I still regret that. I'd be lying if I said that I didn't. And I believe that maybe in time that will be 100% true to me, but it also helps me remember like why I still live. Like when I am in a dark place, it reminds, like that regret sometimes reminds me about why I still do this, because I want to make that right with her. I want to feel like that is gone and feel completely free. And I want her, more importantly, to feel like that is gone and that we are free of that. And sometimes, like, sometimes I'll see her when, like, things are going on, like, in the way she looks at me, and I can still tell that she has that fear of, like, what if she goes back? So I still am making that right. So I know she's very proud of me. Like, she tells me all the time that she's proud of me, and I know that she loves me very much, but I know that I still have work to do there, that, like, I still have to make it right, and I will continue to do that. So nuts and bolts, nuts and bolts, nuts and bolts. Okay. So I ended up, I laughed at her and I watched her break in front of me and then she left and she just walked out and I finished getting ready and I went out that night and I went, when I walked by her door and I checked her door handle, she had locked the door cause she didn't trust that I wasn't going to hurt her. And they knew that I was on the verge of dying, so they, about 2 weeks later, shipped me off to an 18-to-2-year Mormon all-girls rehab because they knew that I was going to die. They knew I was going to die, and they knew that I needed to get away from where I was, that I needed to be physically removed, and that I needed something that had the 12 steps, and this place had the 12 steps, and they also had a lot of help for, they were going to get me a diploma and, like, all this stuff, so they shipped me away, you know, and that place, I'm not someone that knocks rehabs at all. I think that they can be extremely helpful. And what was helpful from that rehab was that, one, there were some things, like, alcoholism is treated by Alcoholics Anonymous. Anything that you have that, like, and I do believe that there are a lot of alcoholics that have other issues, whether it's food, whether it's shopping, whether it's gambling, all that stuff. But Alcoholics Anonymous will not fix those things. That's my experience. Like, I tried to beat a lot of other problems with Alcoholics Anonymous, and, like, it didn't work. And so what that place did was it helped provide me the things I needed to get right in those other areas of my life, specifically food. And, like, there were other issues that I needed, like, life stuff that had happened that I needed to, like, get right with. And that, then they provided me with that help. And the other thing was they provided me with a wonderful woman whose name was Rainey, and she was 14 years sober, and she was a godsend to me. She knew me before I even said anything. You know, she had been through everything that I had been through, And she knew, she just knew me coming in. Like, she was like, one, she was like, this girl's going to detox. And two, this girl needs Alcoholics Anonymous. And so they threw me in a room, you know, and let me detox for 2 weeks. And boy, oh boy, I honestly do not believe I have another one of those in me. Like, I don't believe I have another one of those in me. That was truly like hell on earth. And so I detoxed, and then they, and Rainey got me these special privileges where she was like, you're going to go to AA meetings. I'm your sponsor and we're going to work the steps. And I just was like, oh, okay. I'm like, can you just let me figure, like, I'm still seeing things. Like, can you just let me, like, come down a little bit more? Like, thanks. Like, I'm hallucinating. But she took me to meetings, you know, like, she got me those privileges, and she took me to meetings, and she worked the steps with me, and she read the big book with me, and she really took the time to, like, introduce me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank God for that woman. And at that point, because my parents told me if I left there when I was 18, because I had the option to leave, that I was on my own. Like, don't call us for a plane ticket. Like, you are no longer ours. Like, we change your name. Like, they wanted nothing to do with me if I got out of there when I was 18. So I stayed past my 18th birthday, and I graduated that program. And what I did there, though, was I talked a lot of smack about young people's meetings in AA and how they, like, didn't work and all the crazy there, you know, like, in specific groups and, like, all this stuff. Like, I just talked a lot of shit, like, a lot, because I didn't want to take full responsibility for my actions. And then, again, the hidden hand working in my life mysteriously. The meeting that I talk the most crap about, which is my home group now, the meeting I talked the most about, I came home, and I remember I flew home, and I had the game plan, you know, like, because rehabs make you have a plan when you're going to get home. But it's unfortunate, though, that rehabs, they don't allow you to, like, live in the real world while getting all the stuff. Because, like, I do well in rehabs. Like, I told you, I do well in jail. I do well in institutions. Like, tell me when to get up. Tell me when to go to the bathroom. Tell me when to eat. Tell me when to do, you know, color in the lines. Like, tell me all that stuff, and I can do it. And I can regurgitate what you want me to hear. But then throw me out in the real world, and I, like, am like a rat on a hamster wheel. I'm just like, like, I freak out. So I had this plan, you know, it was move out or go to school. So I was going to go to culinary school, and I got into one. And so I was going to do that. And I came home and I graduated this program, and I was going to go to meetings, you know, like, and I came home on a Sunday, and I knew the only meeting that I knew that was happening on a Sunday was this home group that I talked like all this smack about. And so, and the hidden hand works in mysterious ways, you know, like, and it did exactly what I needed. My parents were checking my mileage when I got home from rehab. You know, they had divorced also through this, because they just, like, my dad was sober and was like, she needs help. And my mom still wanted to love me sober. You know, like, God bless the woman. Still, after all the horrible things I did to her, she still wanted to love me sober. And so they ended up getting divorced, and I got home, and I had this meeting that I talked all this crap about, and I went to it because it was the only meeting that I knew. And so I went there, and no one's, like, it was 400 people deep in this hot-ass church in the middle of D.C., and I got there 30 minutes late. And I was like, this is hell. This is hell. And I walked in, and there was a guy named Pat there, and he had gone to one of the, like, rehab schools that I went to, and he didn't say a word to me. Like, all he did was he just moved over, and he patted the stair next to him, like, come on, you're welcome, and you're welcome here. And, like, that was, like, all, that was what I needed. And I didn't stay sober after that. I ended up going out and using for a little while longer, for about 9 more months, and I picked up fake chips, went to meetings, spewed fake bullshit in meetings, like, the whole, you know, the whole nine, like, had a fake sponsor for a good 9 months. But there's only so long you can keep up that lie. Like, it was freaking miserable. And I, at that point, had told my sponsor I didn't want to go to any women's meetings because the Our Father at the end was too high pitched and it got on my nerves and I couldn't get a message. So, I mean, I had all these excuses, you know, but I left work on that day where I saw myself clearer than I'd ever seen myself, in a bathroom toilet at a bar that I was working at, sober, with a bottle of Jack Daniels and a dinner plate of cocaine. And I just knew I was going to die. Like, I just had this intuitive, like, animalistic instinct that I was going to die. And for the first time ever, and I don't know why I had this, but for the first time I was like, I don't want to. And I think that the reason why I had that feeling was because even though I was lying about my sobriety date, I was going to meetings. So, like, there was a higher power working in my life, like, showing me that there was another way. And, like, that's the only reason why I believe that I had that, like, I had that thought that I wanted to, like, I knew I was going to die. And then immediately, for the first time in my entire life, I had that thought where it's like, I don't want to. Because 2 years prior to that, if, like, death would have been, like, it would have, it, it would have been like the good way out, like honestly, like it would have been almost like relieving. And so I left work, I walked out of work and I quit my job and I drove to a women's meeting. And I don't remember what was shared, but again, God working in my life, you know, drove to a women's meeting because it was the only meeting I knew. And, because it was the only meeting I knew. And I went to this meeting and I didn't listen to the speaker and she stopped talking and I started talking and I just didn't shut up. You know, I vomited everything out. I told them all, like, every truth, and that is when I started actually being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I got completely honest with a group of women, and 2 days later, I got my sponsor, Joyce. I stalked her outside of a meeting in the bushes, and I'd been going to meetings on and off for 4 years, and this girl walked up to Joyce while I was, like, smoking a cigarette in the bushes, like, watching her, like, I'm gonna ask her to be my sponsor, and this girl, Abby, walked up to her and asked her to be her sponsor, and at this point, 4 years on and off going to meetings, I didn't know you could sponsor more than one person. So I thought she took her from me. So I like marched out of the bushes like a bat out of hell and like threw a temper tantrum that I was going to ask you to be my sponsor, you know, like a child. And good old Joyce, you know, just like sort of patted me on the head and was like, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, you're going to be okay. And she immediately took me through the steps, immediately got me started on the steps, you know, like, and she really made it very clear to me that the energy that I had put into drinking and drama, I was now going to put into Alcoholics Anonymous. And that meant that I was going to go to 7 meetings a week. That meant I was going to call her every single day. It meant that that I was going to sit in the meeting the entire hour. You know, like I wasn't going to get up unless it was an emergency. I wasn't going to get up because I was going to show Alcoholics Anonymous the respect I had yet to show it. And she really, you know, she was a carrier. She was a carrier of the message to me. Thank God. And she introduced me to a life beyond my wildest dreams through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she had me write out my entire story. So I was completely honest with one person, at least just one. We would start with one, you know, like now I'm an oversharer. I tell everybody everything. Like, I don't care. Like meetings, people that don't ask, like people are like, are you okay? And I'm like, you know what? This is what's going on. I'll vomit everything. I just don't care anymore. You know, like I'm an oversharer now, where before I was like, all right, Joyce, I'll tell you and only you what's really going on in my real story, you know? How things change. It's awesome. So she had me write out my story. And then for my second step, she had me write out the concept of God that I had at that moment, which was punishing and a scorekeeper and, you know, had no love for me. And then she had me write out what I wanted my higher power to be, the ideals that I wanted my higher power to have, you know, like love and tolerance and patience and someone, you know, forgiveness. And then with the third step, what she had me do is she just told me, she's like, I want you to go out and act every single day like you have that God that you want. How would you act if you really believed? If you really had that faith, how would you act in every situation? And I started being able to literally take that and apply it to like every area of my life. In traffic, you know, like as I'm driving and like someone cuts me off and I'm chasing them down the highway, you know, like if I believed in a God that was forgiving and like that wanted the best for me and wanted me to be my best, would I be chasing this person down the highway at 95 miles an hour? It's like, okay, now we tap on the brakes. It was like those little things like that started to have me like start believing in a higher power and like believing that like I could be better. And if I could be better, like just maybe this AA thing would work for me. And then I went on and I did my fourth step, which I was super pumped about. I'm like one of the only people that was like, yes. Like, I get to tell you why everybody is screwy and why I deserve to drink the way I did for a little bit, you know, at least a little bit. And I wrote out this grudge list. I mean, ooh, it was long. Ooh, boy, it was long. And then I started to realize when Joyce had me write out, like, not my part or my wrongs, but, like, where was I to blame and where was I at fault? I was like, no. People say in meetings it's my part. So I'm going to put my part, but this is their part. That's why I can't look at it that way. Because if I have a part, it means it's not the whole. It means you have a part, too. That's why I have to look at just what it says in the big book. Where was I to blame? Where was I at fault? Which is miserable. So then I did my fifth step and I felt like the biggest turd in the toilet bowl. But I felt like everybody else shared about how they felt great after their fifth step. So I went to the meeting that night and raised my hand and shared about how great I felt, even though I like wanted to die on the inside. Because again, like my looks and you liking me and me being great is everything, which immediately led me to 6 and 7 because you can't live like that for, like, you can't live in the image of what you hope everyone sees of you, because eventually what you'll do is, like, you'll get yourself to a place where you have to start lying, and then if you lie, there's no honesty. If there's no honesty, you'll drink. Like, that's how my life is. So, and then I got to the 8th and 9th step after going through 6 and 7 and really being able to apply the fact that I had to give these things up to God. These defects of character, which go back down to the 7 deadly sins, every single one of them somehow goes back down. So, like, yeah, sure, maybe I shoplift, but I shoplift because I'm envious of, like, all the people around me and what they have. So, like, everything funnels down to the 7 deadly sins, a lot of which go down to fear. So we started working on that and, like, giving it to God and acting as if this was removed, how would I act? Another one of those, like, apply it to your life. If this was removed, how would I act? And then I got to go to the 8th and 9th step, and 8 and 9 were amazing. They changed my life. I got to make amends to the grandmother who, you know, she never told my parents, never. I've now found out never. I called her when I needed to get bailed out of jail. When I was really in it, she was the woman that I called. And to this day, like, she passed away in 2008, but, she never told my parents. She never broke that confidence that, you know, like, she was amazing. And I was able to make amends to her. And that meant that when she was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, I was able to quit my job and take care of her for the last month and a half of her life and do little things like rub lotion into her hands because they were so dry, or sing to her because she loved, You Are My Sunshine. You know, like, I got to do that for her. Now I get to help take care of my grandpa who's not doing well, and he's in Fredericksburg, you know, like, and he's like, he's my whole world too. You know, he's amazing. I get to be there for him because he's so afraid of being forgotten. So, like, just spending time with him, like, that's all he wants. He just wants you to spend time with him. Driving down to Fredericksburg from Tyson sucks. It's like 2.5 freaking hours every freaking time. You know, like, and do I want to do it? God, no. But when I get there and I see, like, he has Alzheimer's. So when I get there, it takes him a minute to recognize me. But when he does, like, his face lights up. Like, how can I not do that? And these are all gifts of AA. And the only reason I do them is because somebody said, hey, that person has a grandfather with Alzheimer's. Go talk to them and see what they did. You know, like, and then I talk to them and they tell me what to do and I do it. And then I'm able to have relationships and it's amazing. And 10, 11, and 12 have been huge, obviously, for the maintenance of my sobriety. And it's because I have to give it away to keep it. And the only way I can give it away is if I have it. So I have to do 10 and 11 because I have to keep a relationship with a higher power. And I have to do 10 because I make mistakes every single day. Every single day I do them. And I have to stay in check. And I don't do a written 10th step every day, but I do spot check inventories and I talk to my sponsor about them. And then I follow up with talking to God about it. And I ask him what he would have me do. And I follow there's directions all throughout this big book. All throughout it, there are directions. Like, if you don't know how to pray, it tells you what you do in the morning, what you do during the day, and what you do at night. You know, like, it's amazing. And the last thing that I'll say is this, is that I have a life beyond my wildest dreams. I really do. But that does not mean that life is good every single day. There are ups, there are downs, people die, cancer, you know, like, losing jobs, getting jobs. And recently what it's been is I had this career that I put all of my eggs into. You know, like, I had this career and this image, you know, like, of, you know, I'm this big event planner, you know, like, and I'm so amazing, you know, like, and I put all my eggs into that basket and I had no idea that I had done that. And what ended up happening is that because I was putting so much time and effort into my job, I stopped going to as many meetings. And then also what was going on was that there's this whole conglomerate of, like, new people coming in, and they're so young, you know, like, I'm young, I know that. But I mean, they're like 15, 16, 17, and 18, and I can get so bitterly judgmental, and I'm still there because sometimes what I perceive is that they have no respect for Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's hard. It's really hard to have patience and tolerance and find that line, because I don't think that the answer is to just let them be, you know, like, because if that's the case, like, a lot of shitty actions are being taken, quite frankly, like, the shitty actions are being taken, and, like, that's not good for AA. So, like, finding that middle ground of, like, respecting, my home group and my AA, and also, like, still having my hand out to that newcomer, like, that's been going on a lot. And the other thing was, after breaking my hip, which was awful, and then I broke my foot because of the crutches I was using for my broken hip, so then it's been, like, miserable, right? It's been miserable. And like, could I get into that whole, like, why are you doing this to me, God? Absolutely. But what also happened while all of this is going on, right? All this awful stuff. What also happened was, you know, like, I got to go to Japan and, like, visit my boyfriend who's over there and, like, experience, like, Alcoholics Anonymous over there, you know, like, and see, like, AA working where, like, there are no English-speaking meetings and, like, he's able to stay sober and, like, get to celebrate my 11th anniversary with him, you know, like, over there. And, like, that's amazing, you know, like, but those are the, I'd rather look at the fact that, like, oh, I have to give up my career than, like, that amazing opportunity, which I was given because I've practiced the principles of AA. And what ended up happening was I had to give up that job. I had to give it up because I was going to drink. And because I was not going to go to meetings anymore because my job was more important. And it's still really hard, like really hard. And you know, I got another job and I'm doing the principles of AA. But what I have found out is that through that job is my job is different, but my life is the same. And my life is the same because AA is the center of my life. And as long as AA is the center of my life, I will be okay. And that I have to continue to do this because God forbid I ever stop giving it away, I will drink again. And I don't want to today. I really don't want to. So thank you very much for having me out to speak.